And now, Stein Online presents Mark Stein on the Town.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And when my lack of education hasn't hurt me none, I can read the writing.
This is the high school, Forest Hills High School. This is the high school when I thought back of all the crap I learned in high school. This is not my neighborhood. I grew up in an adjacent neighborhood that was called Kew Gardens.
That's also a district of London.
I know you guys took it from us.
That's me in a long ago TV special, riding around Queens in a car with Paul Simon as he showed me the scenes of his childhood. From the house where Art Garfunkel lived to the parking lot where he first heard Elvis on the radio. I know they never match my sweet. In this audio special to mark his 70th birthday, we'll hear Paul Simon talk about singing, about songwriting, and about the New York of his boyhood.
This is where I first got laid. I think there's a plaque there. I think I put a plaque there.
Know whether that rather drab parking lot we were looking at as he made that observation merits that historical significance, and I don't know whether he was joking about the plaque, but after the show appeared, I noticed that a lot of rock and roll dictionaries and anthologies asserted that there was in fact a plaque in that parking lot, and fans began making pilgrimages to it looking for it. There was a rather dreary feature in the London newspapers back in those days. I think it was called Rock Holidays, and it advised you where to go on vacation to see significant scenes from your favourite pop star's life. And they lifted quite a bit for their Paul Simon one from my interview riding around with him in the car in Queens that day. Paul Simon was born on October the 13th, 1941, which makes him, golly, older than this lady. And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Everyone knows at least a couple of Paul Simon songs.
Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay.
Garfunkel, he had some of the biggest hits of the 60s. And then...
Just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free.
He launched a successful solo career in the 70s.
Slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
And through the 80s.
If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long lost pal. I can call you Betty, Betty when you call me.
Simon in some while, but there was a period when I used to interview him every couple of years for one thing or another. I once spent a week with him for a BBC documentary, a couple of days filming at his home in Montauk, a couple at his office in the Brill Building, and a couple more driving around boyhood haunts in Queens, as we heard at the beginning. I had a very good time. And at the end of the week, he was kind enough to tell me, as we were outside in his garden, and he'd just pointed out, we were at Montauk looking out over the ocean, and he pointed out his neighbour Dick Cavett, and he told me he'd been surprised that I'd been able to hold his interest, which seems fair enough. To me, he was wry and bemused, and for a rock star, he had a rare sense of proportion. He's supposedly a notoriously difficult interviewee, but on the other hand, he's had some notoriously appalling interviewers. When I flew into New York to do the show, I was driven to the BBC studios in Rockefeller Center, plunked down by the producer in a chair, and still jet-lagged, forced to watch unedited footage of previous disastrous Paul Simon interviews. My favorite moment came when dear old Annie Nightingale, a legendary figure at the Beeb, asks Paul how he and Art Garfunkel wrote their songs together, and Paul replies very calmly that he wrote all the songs by himself. Annie thinks she's teased some great revelation out of him. "Do we have a little scoop here?" she asks, and Paul shoots a disbelieving glance at some minder off camera and says with a rueful smile, "I don't think so. No, indeed." As is generally well known, Paul wrote the songs and always had. On the first day of shooting for that TV special, I talked him into singing very charmingly the first song he ever wrote back when he was 13. We'll hear that a bit later. He was, as I said, fun to interview. He always returned the ball, as Cole Porter said of the Duchess of Windsor. The only kind of slight awkward moment came when we were driving out from Manhattan to Queens, and we came to the 59th Street Bridge, as in the 59th Street Bridge song, which is the official title of this hit.
Slow down, you move too fast. Got to make the morning last, just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, feeling groovy. Hello, lamppost, what you knowin'? I've come to watch your flowers growing. Ain't you got no rhymes for me? Doo-doo-doo-doo, feeling groovy.
As we approached the 59th Street Bridge in his car, the director thought it might be cute if Paul were to turn to a lamppost and say, "Hello, lamppost, what you knowin'? I've come to watch your flowers growing." We didn't get too far with that idea. There's a lot we discussed on that interview and in various others, but in view of the fact that we're marking his 70 and 10, I thought it would be appropriate to concentrate on his early years, that boyhood in New York, the first singers he listened to, the first songs he wrote, and the first memories, the ones that were to recur again and again in his lyrics over the years. When you're filming in a car, now, the conventions are slightly wacky. There's Paul Simon driving, and there's me barking questions at him, and a cameraman twisted around trying to film, and a director and sound guy wedged up in the back, and there's no retakes. He's driving, you're yakking, he's yakking, and you hope by the end of the day that it all hangs together. So let's start at the beginning, in Queens, outside the house where he grew up.
This is my street, 70th Road. Number 62 is my house.
Where was your room?
At the top. Up on the top was my bedroom, and the little window next to me was my brother's room, which is only fair since he's my younger brother and had no business being here in the first place.
Were you up there listening to rock and roll in the evenings?
That's right. That's exactly right.
First thing I remember, I was lying in my bed. Couldn't have been no more than one or two. And I remember there was a radio coming from the room next door, and my mother laughed the way some ladies do. When it's late in the evening and the music's seeping through.
My father, he was always pulling into another driveway because these houses look exactly the same. They're all attached. These are just attached houses, you know. Then this was considered to be like almost the country. It was so far away from New York City. And it was the end of the subway line.
He was a musician, though, wasn't he?
Yeah.
What sort of things did he play?
He was a bass player. He did a lot of different work. He primarily played. He was a band leader. They did club dates, and he did recordings. I mean, in fact, for as much as he disliked rock and roll, he was on several of the old rock and roll records that I knew. I mean, sometimes it would come on the radio and he'd say, wait a minute, I think I played on this one.
The next thing I remember, I'm walking down the street. I'm feeling all right. I'm with my boys and with my troops, yeah. And down along the avenue, some guys were shooting pool. And I heard the sound of acapella groups, yeah. Singing late in the evening. And all the girls out on the street.
This jockey in New York named Alan Freed, and he had a show called The Moondog Show. It was named after this famous beggar who used to hang around Midtown Manhattan. His name was Moondog. He was dressed like a Viking. He used to hold a spear, and he was dressed like a Viking, and his name was Moondog. And Alan Freed's show was called The Moondog Show. And one night he came on and he said, we're not allowed to call our show the Moondog Show anymore because Moondog had gotten an injunction and he was forbidden to use the name. So he said, we're not going to call it the Moondog Show anymore. We're going to call it Alan Freed's Rock and Roll Party. And that was the first time that the name rock and roll was invented. I mean, that, or applied to this, you know, vast... diversion of music, including country and including blues and including doo-wop, all of that became was called rock and roll. My mama loves me, she loves me. She get down on her knees and hug me. And she loves me like a rock. There was one station that played rock and roll, and that was on 6 days a week. And it wasn't on Sundays. And I used to search the dial trying to find something to listen to on Sundays. And the closest thing to it was gospel. So I liked gospel from a very early age. And when I heard gospel quartets, I really loved it.
I'm a consummated man. Want to be a man.
But this supermarket, which I don't remember what it was called. I think it was called Grand Union, and it was now called Casina Farms, which is fairly ludicrous. As you can see, there isn't a farm.
In the farm for miles.
20 miles. And I remember in that parking lot being in the back seat of my parents' car when they went shopping and hearing Elvis Presley for the first time on the radio. The Elvis Presley recording, That's All Right, Mama. The announcer said, now here's a singer named Elvis Presley. Every time he performs in the South, there's riots when he sings. I went home. I remember talking about Elvis Presley to my grandmother, who was under the impression that he was Jewish. She thought his name was Alvin Presley. Was it Alvin Presley? Is he Jewish? I don't think so, Grandma.
Let's pause Elvis for a moment there. When this show was first broadcast on American television, there was a reviewer, I think it was in the Philadelphia Inquirer, who said, Paul Simon takes huge pleasure in mocking the pompous BBC interviewer, unquote. Well, to be honest, he didn't take that much pleasure in mocking me, but here's an example of that. I thought I'd come up with a kind of rather artful segue between Elvis and That's All Right Now, Mama, and all that, and the title track of the big blockbuster Paul Simon album, Graceland. So I asked him a question based on the lyric, my traveling companion is 9 years old. He's the child of my first marriage. I asked him a question basically deriving from that lyric. And Paul Simon said rather dryly, all the songs aren't exactly about what happened. There's an element of imagination in there. So then I try to recover from my faux pas with a follow-up question, and he immediately boots me in the crotch over that one just as artfully, but with a kind of droll smile on his face. Anyway, here's my, what the Philadelphia Inquirer thought was my pompous question.
Presley died in 1977, and a few years after that, you and your son made the trip to Graceland, his rather garish mansion, and yet you've somehow managed to turn the name into a symbol of something that is elegiac and lyrical on the title song of your album.
Well, first of all, I never went there with my son. I just, you know, all the songs aren't exactly about what happened. There's some element of imagination in there.
Did you go there in your imagination?
No, I actually went there. I found myself writing a song called Graceland, and I really was resistant to it. I didn't want to write a song called Graceland, but I couldn't get rid of it. It just stayed with me, and then I thought, well, maybe I'm going to write a song about Graceland, and I really don't know what I'm writing about yet. And it probably makes sense to go there and see if, in fact, what I'm looking for is in Graceland. I was in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I drove up to northern Louisiana through the Mississippi Delta, and up through Mississippi, and then into Memphis. And that trip was the opening verse of the song.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I'm following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm going to Graceland, Graceland, from Memphis, Tennessee. I'm going to Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland. My traveling companion is 9 years old. He is the child of my first marriage.
To me, it was a father and son trip. Now, I don't know whether I'm writing about me and my son or me and my father, or it doesn't really matter. It's all mixed up, same. And it's about a reconciliation with a big event in the life, losing love. And the setting of Elvis Presley's home, it's like a pilgrimage for people.
She said, losing love is like a window in your heart. Everybody sees you're blown apart. Everybody sees the wind blow. I'm going to Graceland, Memphis, Tennessee. I'm going to Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland. Am I traveling back? There's a ghost in empty
Question-wise, I did rather better in this segment of the interview, and I suggested there was a similarity between the vocal sounds, the harmonies Paul Simon heard in South Africa, the sound that started what became known as world music, in effect, and the doo-wop vocal groups that he fell in love with back in the 50s.
Well, I think Ladysmith Black Mambazo has that sound. A cappella. Three-chord a cappella groups. I mean, except Black Mambazo has such a sophisticated degree that it would be a super doo-wop group. And it was 10 members. And the usual group is 4 or 5 people.
I begged you over and over again. I pleaded over and over again. Why don't I back up and tell you goodbye? I love you, that's why.
That's The Moon Glows, and Over Again. You know, I love The Moon Glows, but about the only occasion in this discussion when Paul Simon actually bristled was when I suggested to him that many of his younger fans, and in fact most members of the rock generation, would find that sound corny. They think of doo-wop as corny.
I think the reason it seems corny is that the 50s, as it's been depicted, I mean, a show like Grease, well, that was nothing like what it was. It's a parody, and it's a comedic parody, and it's a joke. It seems like it's a joke. What it was, and what was so exciting about it was the first time that middle-class white America heard black culture. The energy and the stimulation that occurred from that was explosive. And that's Elvis Presley. His great contribution is he's the synthesis that brought together those two strands of the culture. In his case, it was country music and rhythm and blues, southern rhythm and blues. But in the cities, it was doo-wop.
Oh, earth angel, earth angel.
Wow.
Penguins and Earth Angel. While we were driving around, we happened to cross again. I think it was back from Manhattan going back to Queens, the 59th Street Bridge, the Feeling Groovy Bridge. And the following day, he still hadn't forgotten that bit about doo-wop being corny, because we were listening to WCBS, the oldie station in New York, and the Penguins singing Earth Angel came on the radio. And he turned to me accusingly and said, "There, do you think this is corny?" He hadn't forgotten it. Earth Angel, the Penguins. When Paul Simon began writing songs, a lot of those early songs sounded a lot like the things the Penguins were singing. Out at his home at Montauk, I asked him if he remembered the first song he'd ever written. And he picked up his guitar. This is Paul Simon live.
The first song that we sang was called "The Girl for Me." It went like this:
"The girl for me is standing there. That that's the one. Flowers in her hair, I'll always love her, and I know she'll be true. She'll be true about the.
I had a great temptation to join in on the sort of do bass line. But
that was our first song. I wrote that when I was 13.
Back in the car, driving around Queens, Paul Simon showed me where he began his singing career. High school.
Parsons Junior High School. This is where I started to sing with Art Garfunkel. Was that little song I sang for you out in Montauk, The Girl For Me, that we wrote that in his house and we sang it here in the assembly. It was a big hit. Other people used to sing the song. Groups used to sing the song on street corners, like around here. In fact, at one point, somebody offered to buy the song from me for $25. And I said, of course. And Artie's father said, don't sell that song, don't do that. I'll buy it, which of course wouldn't have been fun at all. So he wouldn't let me sell it. But I really wanted to sell it. I said I can write another one. This is easy.
And he did write another one.
Ooh-ba-ba-loo-cha-ba, you're mine. Say, ooh-ba-ba-loo-cha-ba, you're mine. Hey, schoolgirl in the second row. The teacher's looking over, so I gotta whisper way down low. You say, ooh-ba-ba-loo-cha-ba, let's meet.
Hey, school girl. I wrote that with Art Garfunkel when I was 14 years old, and we recorded it when we were 15.
It must, though, make you a great hero with the girls to have a record out when you're 15 years old.
That's why everybody does it. How everybody gets into rock and roll.
When did you first meet Art then?
That was just when I was 10 years old. In the fourth grade. He was the kid who sang in the assembly, in the talent show. He sang, and everybody thought it was just great.
What was it he sang back then?
They tried to tell us we're too young. He had this beautiful, angelic voice. When I heard that, I said, I wonder if I can sing. So much fuss over Garfunkel. I think I'll see if I can sing something.
I am just a boy, not a mighty man. Your love gives me strength to do the best that I can.
If that doesn't sound a lot like the Paul Simon of Graceland and Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes and You Can Call Me Al and Slip Sliding Away, well, it's connected by his constant revisiting of his childhood memories from New York in the 1950s. And by way of illustration of that, I asked him to take me through a song of his from the 1980s that looks back to that period in his life, The Late Great Johnny Ace.
The Late Great Johnny Ace is a song about violence in America. I start off by talking about Johnny Ace because it's an early memory of, you know, listening on the radio and hearing Alan Freed say that Johnny Ace had killed himself playing Russian roulette.
I was reading a magazine, thinking of a rock and roll song. The year was 1954, and I hadn't been playing that long. when a man came on the radio, and this is what he said. He said, I hate to break it to his fans, but Johnny Ace is dead. Yeah, yeah. Well, I really wasn't such a Johnny Ace fan, but I felt bad all the same. So I sent away for his photograph, and I waited till it came. It came all the way from Texas, with a sad and simple face. And they signed it on the bottom, from the late great Johnny Ace.
And it was the first time that I can remember any kind of violence like that. That was in the middle of the 1950s. By the early 1960s, John Kennedy was assassinated, and then, well, the rest of the history everybody knows.
It was the year of the Beatles, it was the year of the Stones, the year after JFK. We were staying up all night and giving the days away. And the music was flowing, amazing and blowing.
And by the time John Lennon was killed, as shocking as it was, it almost didn't have the impact that it had on me the first time I heard that Johnny Ace is dead.
On a cold December evening, I was walking through the Christmas time, when a stranger came up and asked me if I had heard John Lennon die. And the two of us went to this bar, we stayed to close the flames, and every song we played was for the late great Johnny Ace.
Not really about a nostalgic view of the 50s. I'm only using Johnny Ace as a metaphor for all of the three Johnny Aces, you know, John Kennedy, John Lennon, and Johnny Ace.
By the time Paul Simon wrote that song, he had his offices in New York's famous Brill Building. It's about the most famous songwriting building in New York. It's been home to everyone from my old friend Irving Caesar, who wrote Tea for Two and Swanee and Just a Gigolo, up to the young Neil Sedaka and Carole King. That was the acme of songwriting, the most prestigious building in the New York business at the time Paul Simon got started. But he and Art Garfunkel went there. They looked around it, but that wasn't the kind of building they figured they had a chance of getting into, not back then.
I went as a teenager with Art Garfunkel was to the little record companies that were around. We weren't at the level of the Brill Building. The Brill Building was like a place that you get scared to go into. It was the big publishing companies were there. Where we went were to the little buildings that were scattered around Midtown. record companies that, you know, long since gone. And you could walk in the door and say, we're a duo, we sing and we write songs. And they'd say, well, sing it. So you'd take out your guitar and you'd sing a song.
I'll soar away.
Because the Lone Ranger. Oh, he rides around on a big white horse. He's as cool as he can be. And my baby fell in love with him when she saw him on TV. And since that day, I'm sorry to say, she hasn't had time for me. Cause he goes bang, bang. He's the Lone Team Ranger.
Those sort of songs, and the songs you wrote in the couple of years following that, things like The Lone Teen Ranger, they had great novelty ideas, a kind of clever little gimmick in them.
Well, by the time this song I wrote when I was 13 years old, and it's probably a real song. I mean, I'm probably thinking of a girl. By the time I get up to Lone Teen Ranger and that, I was trying to write commercial songs. I mean, I was enough aware of the business that I was trying to write a hit.
And when you look at the songs that you've written in the last few years, something like Hearts and Bones, which has a much freer form, it's not constrained like something like The Lone Teen Ranger by Tin Pan Alley conventions.
I should stop you here because there's a misunderstanding about the Tin Pan Alley idea too. Tin Pan Alley was a term that really referred to an era before rock and roll, and it was reapplied to the Carole King, Jerry Goffin people, and the first things that they wrote were breakthroughs, really. Will You Love Me Tomorrow, and they were really they understood what the music was, and they took it a little bit further. Then when it became hits, they became specialists at repeating themselves. You know, I think good songs are all about sound. I think that's what music is about. And the songwriter is listening to hear whether he or she is creating a sound that has some meaning. I mean, unless you're writing it as strictly on a commercial basis. I mean, unless you're being a hack, even there, a good hack has to have some kind of sensitivity. But if you're writing a song that's supposed to be a story, you're listening to the sound, and the sound is what tells you whether to stay by the rules or break the rules.
You talk about a good hack. I suppose it's a kind of shorthand, but really in the early 60s you weren't a terribly good hack. When you were trying to write commercial songs, you weren't very good at it.
No, I wasn't. I couldn't do it. And so I think that's the first time that I moved to England, around 1963.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts escaping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently for. Every day is an endless stream of cigarettes and magazines. Mm-hmm.
each town looks the same to me. The movies and the factories and every stranger's face I see reminds me that I long to be homeward bound. I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts are escaping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently for me. Tonight I'll sing my songs again. I'll play the game and pretend. But all my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity, like emptiness and harmony. I need someone to comfort me. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts are escaping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silent.
I said to Paul Simon out at his place at Montauk that sound always sounded to me like a real classic American train song. And he said, what do you mean? The very first line is, I'm sitting at a railway station. Railway station, not railroad station. That's American. Railway station is British. In fact, he wrote it on the platform at Widnes Railway Station in Liverpool after he'd moved to England in the 1960s. And it was a funny period in his life. And a few years later, I think it was in Paris, I was interviewing him again. We started talking about that period in his life, and he asked me about all kinds of people who'd been kind of around at that time, like Cilla Black, for example, had a big hit with You're My World. Yeah, she was a Liverpudlian singer. He said, what's Cilla doing now? I said, oh, she's hosting the British version of Blind Date. And he said, that's what I love about Britain. In America, they'd never let me host Blind Date. It was important in his life for other reasons too. The early 1960s in England was when he first began writing what we now think of as Paul Simon songs.
Tonight I'll sing my songs again, and I'll play the game and pretend. Mm-hmm. But all of my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity, like emptiness and harmony.
The music started to drop in quality in the very end of the 50s and into the early 60s because it started to be packaged in a very sophisticated way. And the forces that broke that style were the Beach Boys, first of all, came out of California and were, again, they were talking about a culture that was real. They weren't inventing it to sell to people. They were talking about what life was in California, surfing. And the Beatles, coming from Liverpool, again, they were talking about a culture that was real. And Bob Dylan taking the folk movement. It didn't have anything to do with corporations. Corporations were surprised that this stuff was a hit.
A hit song brought Paul Simon back to America. A major work, at least according to Art Garfunkel's sleeve notes, about man's inability to communicate with man.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Streets of cobblestone.
it was just one block back, but it was a corner just like this that when Sound of Silence was a number one record, and I had just come back from England. And Art was still living at home. He was still at college, and he was still living at home. We're going to pass his house in a minute. And we were sitting in my car. I think I had a Sunbeam Alpine. And we were sitting in the car, smoking, and Sound of Silence came on, and they said, number one record, The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. We were just sitting there at night. We didn't have anything to do. And Artie turned to me and he said, those guys must be having so much fun. Here's, this is where Art Garfunkel's family still lives. That's where he grew up.
Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words, like silent raindrops, fell. Echo in the world of silence. And the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. Sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming, and the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, tenement halls, whispering the sounds of silence.
The song that marks the dividing line between Paul Simon, the boy from Queens, and Paul Simon, singer, songwriter, and star for the best part of half a century now. In part two of this special, I'll talk with Paul Simon about songwriting, about techniques, about music, about lyrics, about harmony, and we will explore that side of his work. But that's where we leave it today, with the song that made Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel stars, The Sound of Silence. Time to say goodbye, darkness, my old friend. We'll say hello again in part two. See you then.